It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Welcome to a first place again, Rico Bronya. The New York Mets get a split against the Atlanta Braves. We watch a grown man pop an Achilles and basically watch his career go up in flames. That was pretty depressing. But the New York Mets do win back-to-back games against the Atlanta Braves. It can be done. They are allowed to beat the Braves. They've been able to do it. And with the help of our dear friends from Houston, Texas, the Houston Astros, the Philadelphia Phillies go to Houston. They score one run in three games. And voila, the New York Mets are a first-place team. If you want to hear breakdowns about the game one loss and the game two loss, you could go back to episode 504 and 503. We have a drive home podcast after the game one loss and an instant reaction, Rico Bronya, to the game two loss. So we will focus on the two victories, the split, the injury to Griffin Canning, the Rico, I'm the man now star of the series, the net negative, and we will look ahead to what's next. Let's start with Canning. I hate to start with a negative, but dude, that sucked. And it was also really random. And I'm not sure if anybody actually saw it happen live because we're all looking down. I know I am. I'm writing down, oh, Nick Allen grounded out to shortstop. Let me put my 6-3 in the book. And as I'm putting it in, I hear a gasp from the crowd at Citi Field. And that gasp shows us Griffin Canning laying on the ground. And in a weird way, it reminded me of Kodai Senga last year when all of a sudden it looked like he got shot. And he was laying on the ground. Of course, it turned into the calf injury, an injury that wiped out the rest of his regular season. So we see Canning on the ground. I'm at this game with my son, a couple of friends, and we're all conversing. What the hell happened? Did anybody see it happen? Now, they don't show the replay on the scoreboard at Citi Field. So what everybody has to do, including myself, is go to their phone and try to find a video of it. And you see the video of it. And it sure as hell looks like a bad Achilles injury, something the Mets aren't confirming, but they're certainly surmising. And so before we get into what this does to the Mets and obviously what it did to them in this game, you feel awful for Griffin Canning. Griffin Canning signed a one-year deal with the New York Mets, and his career was being fixed, whether it was the pitching lab or it was the pitching lab or it was, well, the pitching lab. Griffin Canning was putting together a really solid season, the best year of his career. And for it to go up in flames in such a horrific way is heartbreaking for him. So before we get into even how it impacts the team, I feel awful for Griffin Canning. I wonder what this does to his career moving forward. Hopefully he'll be able to make a speedy recovery, a complete recovery, and hopefully he could pick up where he left off because he was showing a lot of promise, including in this game. I mean, he retired the first six guys. And yes, there was an audible, ooh, he's pitching a no-hitter. Oh, he's six up, six down. Like, that occurred in my section. So, just horrible for Griffin Canning. But it was a stunner, especially watching him laying there on the ground.
Carlos Mendoza kind of said that they all believe it's an Achilles. They didn't. Obviously, you can't confirm it. He's got the MRI coming later on, probably tomorrow, whatever it is. But he basically said the same thing we all feel, too. So they're pretty much aware of it.
Yeah, it's the Aaron Rodgers situation. You know, when Aaron Rodgers went down, we knew it was an Achilles. The Jets said, we fear it's an Achilles. And then the following day, report comes out. Yes, it's the Achilles. So unfortunately, that's what's going to happen with Griffin Canning. This was a Thursday night baseball game sometime on Friday. Maybe you already know this as you're listening to the Rico Bronya. We're going to get the bad news for Griffin Canning. And, you know, he goes down, and before you could even contemplate next week, you know, and who's taking a spot in the rotation and how quickly Sean Manaea could return, it goes to this game, which is an important game. Now, the last time we did a Rico Bronya episode 504 after the Mets lost those first two games, I looked into the camera. I said very powerfully into the microphone, go win the next five. Go win the next two against Atlanta. Sweep the Pittsburgh Pirates, and you could erase. You could erase what's happened over the last week and a half. Now, they haven't done the Pittsburgh part, but they responded. And they responded on the previous night by winning 7-3. But in the midst of this game, in the top of the third inning of a scoreless game in which who knows what the offense is going to do, and Griffin Canning knocked out with two outs in the third inning with a runner in scoring position and Ronald Acuña Jr. warming up, and Austin Warren coming into the game, who had just been called up because they sent out Jonathan Pitaro, who had just been called up because they sent out Dickie Lovelady, who just got claimed. Like, basically, it's the movement of pitchers. It's the escalator of pitchers. This guy pitches, thank you, see you later. This guy pitches, thank you, see you later. So Austin Warren, of all people, comes in. Forget about how many innings he's going to give you. I'm thinking, can he get Ronald Acuña Jr. out? I mean, it's a 0-0 game in the top of the third inning. Is he going to get this last out? And what an incredible job, and a stunningly incredible job by Austin Warren. Because not only does he get Acuña to pop up weakly to second base, in the fourth inning, he gives up what was an innocent ground ball single to Marcell Ozuna. And shockingly, Tyrone Taylor just overruns it and hands the Atlanta Braves an extra base. And over the course of this stretch where the Mets have not played well, they've done a lot of things badly. And one of the things they've done badly is just make little mistakes that an opponent can capitalize on. And that felt like a mistake that the opponent was going to be able to capitalize, especially Atlanta, especially with who is now in this game, Austin Warren, and knowing if Austin Warren's going to get through the fourth or fifth inning, okay, what about the sixth? What about the seventh? What about the eighth? And is the offense going to do anything? Because in the bottom of the third inning of this game, they are set up beautifully when Ronnie Mauricio hits that little blooper in a right field for a base hit, and alertly when Torrens is going first to third and the throw's going into third, very alertly takes second base. Really smart heads-up base running by Ronnie Mauricio, which set up second and third, one out, top of the order coming up. And what happens? Lindor, who is, let's face it, has done very little against Atlanta and very little recently, strikes out in a spot in which the second baseman and the shortstop are back. If he hits a weak ground ball to second base, it's 1-0 Mets. If he hits a weak ground ball to shortstop, it's 1-0 Mets. Obviously, if he hits the ball to the outfield and the third base coach, Mike Sarbaugh, actually has the balls to send the runner, which he doesn't do half the time, more on that later, it's 1-0 Mets. And Lindor strikes out. And Brandon Nimmo swings at the first pitch and pops up. I mentioned the swing at the first pitch thing because I know that bothers Pete, even though we've seen plenty of swing at the first pitch success. I was going over this on Evan and Tiki. We did our show from the Cadillac Club before the finale of this series, and we were having a debate, a discussion on swinging at the first pitch, how Soto swung at the first pitch in the home run he hit in game three. And in the finale of this series, the game we're talking about now, Pete Alonso's two-out RBI single in the fifth inning came on the first pitch. So sometimes there is first pitch success, but the Met lack of big hits continued in the bottom of the third inning of this game. And that's why Austin Warren working out of that little jam of a runner on second, less than two outs in the fourth inning, was great. And then he pitches a 1-2-3 fifth. And it's like, man, you got to pinch yourself. Austin Warren gave this team 2 1/3 scoreless innings. Like, what the hell's going on? And luckily this offense was able to do something. Tyrone Taylor hit a sacrifice fly right after Jeff McNeil should have hit a sacrifice fly. But again, Mike Sarbaugh, the third base coach, who was allergic to being aggressive on the base paths, decided to hold the runner at third, Juan Soto, on a play in which I know there's nobody out, so you want to be smart. You also can be aggressive. You're allowed to be aggressive. And he wasn't aggressive. And there have been other examples of that. But luckily, Tyrone Taylor hit it deep enough for a sacrifice fly. And then in the fifth inning, I mentioned Pete Alonso, who I got to give Pete a lot of credit for this. Pete Alonso's been quiet over the last 2 weeks, but his slumps in 2025, very different than his slumps of the past. Like, his slumps now are, he's not hitting a home run. He's going 1-for-4. It's not good, but it's not awful. Like, it's not 0-for-18, you know, with 11 strikeouts. So his slumps and the slump that he was in hasn't been as deep and dark as it was a year ago. And maybe he's out of it because he put together a three-hit game, including one ball that I thought was getting out. I thought Alonso was going to complete his promise to me of hitting a home run. He actually promised three, but you know, he was being a little bit of a pig there. Three home runs. But he goes opposite field on that ball in the fourth inning. That was the rally that gave them their first run. I thought it was a two-run home run. I also thought Juan Soto should have been sent. That was another example of Mike Sarbaugh being the opposite of aggressive, whatever term you want to use. And you could use whatever term you want. But Pete comes through with the big two-out RBI single to give them a 2-0 lead. But the pitching was the story. And what was so encouraging about what they did in this game four of the series is that you saw this bullpen, which at times has been bad, at times in this series and this losing streak or losing stretch has been bad, we saw unusual guys step up. A guy like Austin Warren go out and get seven outs. And then Dednell Nunez. And the Dednell Nunez thing may be the most encouraging thing of them all. Because last year, Nunez was a great weapon. And we came into the season thinking, oh, that's a guy who will definitely be in this bullpen. That's a guy who will definitely be asked to get big outs in this bullpen. And the Mets took it very easy with him in spring training. He didn't make the team. He didn't pitch well in AAA. He came up. He wasn't impressive. Couldn't throw strikes. Goes back to AAA. Isn't impressive. And really, it feels like the only reason he's back is because they need arms. And in this spot, he comes into a game in the sixth inning with a 2-0 lead, facing nine, but then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of this order. And even though Ronald Acuna Jr. just missed hitting a home run that made it 2-1, he goes out and he doesn't only strike out four guys in a row. He strikes out Matt Olson. He strikes out Marcell Ozuna. He strikes out Austin Riley. He strikes out Sean Murphy. A very impressive, dominant performance by Dednell Nunez, to where you start to think, can he become that weapon we thought he was? Like, is this the kind of performance where Dednell Nunez not only saves them on a night where they needed saving, especially because of what had happened to Griffin Canning, but can Dednell Nunez re-enter the circle of trust? Now, I'm not ready to do that off of this game, but I think what he has earned is more opportunities. That's what he's earned. Now, the Mets are in a very tricky spot because they're still playing every single day. They've got three games in Pittsburgh coming up. So, unfortunately, Dednell Nunez is certainly a candidate to be in the shuffle. He's a candidate to go right back down to AAA. I think Austin Warren is the likeliest guy because he threw 2 1/3 innings. But as the Mets continue to look to refresh their arms, unfortunately, pitching well doesn't guarantee you stay. Unfortunately, it's availability that matters the most. The good news is they have an off day on Monday. They have another off day the following week. And before you know it, it's the All-Star break. So the Mets have a chance to kind of refresh themselves. Just not yet. But a very impressive performance by Dednell Nunez. And then Ryan Stanek gets the job done. Edwin Diaz gets the job done. And the Mets, stunningly, in a game in which Griffin Canning has to leave with two outs in the third inning, the bullpen of Austin Warren, Dednell Nunez, Ryan Stanek, and Edwin Diaz pitch a three-hit, but here's the best part, zero-walk shutout. Zero walks? This is the definition of baseball making no sense. The Mets have not been able to pitch over this stretch. Not able to pitch. And what else have they not been able to do over this stretch? Throw damn strikes. And here you've got, especially Warren and Nunez, Dednell Nunez and Austin Warren pitched a combined 4 1/3 innings, gave up one hit, and didn't walk anybody. Like, makes no sense. And by the way, we needed this. Considering the agony of the last 2 weeks, considering the bad baseball we've seen over the last 2 weeks, bullpen blowing games over the last 2 weeks, like brutal losses. The Atlanta game, or both Atlanta games, which one? The one on the road, the one at home a few days ago. To get this kind of effort from the bullpen, so cleanly, so stress-free. Like, that is a that's baseball moment. And it gave the bats enough time to actually do something. They didn't fully explode, but, you know, Jeff McNeil puts together a nice clutch two-out, two-run single when Soto and Alonso put together a rally in the bottom of the seventh inning. And it's a really nice, clean victory that at least makes you say, all right, Griffin Canning's out. For one day, the Mets survived. And now we'll talk about what they have to do longer term, because the Mets do have a little bit of a hole. I'll get to that in a few minutes. Let me get to game three, the game that they won when they finally beat the Atlanta Braves. And really, that came down to the offense giving you that one big inning. You know, they get the solo home run from Juan Soto. Or I'm sorry, from Roddy Mauricio. He's the guy that really set the tone by going deep. And you know what? I want to take some credit on something. On our last Rico Bronya, episode 504, we were all pissed off. I was pissed off. We were all angry. This team sucks. This team is awful. Oh, my God, it's the end of the world. And why I was concerned and bothered and pissed, there were a few positives I pointed out. And one of the positives was that Ronnie Mauricio in the Fugazi rally of the ninth inning hit an RBI double against Raisel Iglesias. And what I said at the time was, hey, you never know. Maybe that double is going to lead to something. Maybe it gets him going. Well, in his first at-bat of game three of this series on Wednesday, Mauricio hits a home run. He ends up going 3-for-4. He followed that up with a 1-for-4. So Ronnie Mauricio is building or has built off of that RBI double against Iglesias. So for the amount of times I say stuff like that, because you know how if you rolled your eyes, you're like, I'm going to build off of that. What the hell is that? Well, let's be honest. He did build off of that. So there you go. I don't want credit. Give Ronnie Mauricio credit. But the Wednesday game really turned in to the Juan Soto game, because after Holmes gives up the home run to Drake Baldwin to immediately say, oh, 1-0 lead, here it is right back. You have Juan Soto hitting a home run. You have the rally with Jeff McNeil ripping a double, Marte sac fly, Brett Beatty behind in the count RBI single, sac fly Lindor, Nimmo behind in the count RBI single, a Soto home run late. You got to see a little bit of an offensive explosion, at least for one inning. But let's not get lost by, I think, one of the most important plays of the season, let alone this series. Top of the first inning. Remember, the Mets have lost the first two games of this series in agonizingly depressing fashion. Whether it was blowing the lead in game two, which they did, 3-0 lead. Whether it was Juan Soto striking out with guys on base and then the bats going down limp after Paul Blackburn gave up those early runs. You are now 0-5 against Atlanta. And Clay Holmes gave up a two-run home run to Marcelo Ozuna. I mean, that essentially happened. One out, nobody on, top of the first. He walks Matt Olson on four pitches. He's ahead of Ozuna 0-2, and Ozuna hits a ball that's over the fence. And Jeff McNeil, playing center field, makes this incredible leaping catch. If he doesn't make that catch to rob Ozuna of a two-run home run, it's 2-0 Atlanta. And I cannot tell you the game plays out the same way. How could you say that? You don't know it. And maybe the Met bats overstress themselves, realizing, crap, we're losing this game. Crap, we got to score runs. Crap, immediately we're down 2-0. I think Jeff McNeil's leaping catch against Marcelo Ozuna in game 81 of this season to this point, and it will probably change, but to this point is the most important defensive play the Mets have made all year. I'd argue that. I think the complexion of this series is different. That game is certainly different. And that was an incredibly clutch, awesome, amazing catch. And it kept the game tied until the Mets could take the 1-0 lead. And even when Atlanta ties it, all right, it's a 1-1 game, and the Met bats responded immediately. Obviously, that game also turned into the Juan Soto game. Soto hitting the home run on the first pitch of the fourth inning after Holmes had given up the lead. And then obviously the home run late. It'd be nice if Soto hit some home runs with guys on base. Just saying, beggars can't be choosers right now. The Mets are hitting home runs. It just seems like all of them are with nobody on base. Hopefully that can change. But hey, they put together the big inning. They give you the five-run fourth inning. They get a decent performance by Clay Holmes. Look, the difference between Clay Holmes in this start and Clay Holmes in his previous start is that he was able to get through the fifth inning and not, you know, basically ask your bullpen to get guys out when you're leaving inherited runners on base. That was the difference. Like, Clay Holmes, with two on and two out against Austin Riley, got the job done and got him out to end the fifth inning. And so instead of it being 4 2/3 innings, three runs, it's a very organized five innings, one run. And even though it's not deep enough in a game, and we know that's a big problem this team has, five innings, one run's fine. It's an acceptable performance. It was not dominant by Clay Holmes. He walked four guys. There were guys on base every inning. He got bailed out by a great play by Jeff McNeil. But at the end of the day, five innings, one run is five innings, one run. I'm not concerned about Clay Holmes more than I'm just skeptical of how this is going to continue. And not that he can't continue in the rotation, but I've noticed that the Mets are being careful with him in terms of when he pitches. They're not pitching him on regular rest. Now, is that a hard, fast rule like it was for Kodai Senga? Clay Holmes is literally, I was looking this up the other day and I want to confirm it before I say it again. I think he's only made one start on regular rest this entire season. And if you look at when they inserted Frankie Montas this week, it conveniently pushed Clay Holmes back. So the Mets are probably doing the right thing when I say that they're doing this, which is handling him very carefully. They're handling him very carefully because he's throwing an amount of innings that he's not used to. And I can confirm, Clay Holmes has made one start on regular rest. And really, overall, the Mets have been careful with anybody pitching on regular rest. Like, Tyler McGill did it a bunch of times. Griffin Canning's done it a few times. Obviously, both those guys are out right now. Not that doing that on regular rest had anything to do with it. Even David Peterson's only done it once or twice. So I wonder if the Mets are going to continue to try to do that with Clay because he is in uncharted territory. Now, we talked about this when they signed Clay Holmes initially, which is, would they ever move him back to the bullpen? We know he can be a great weapon out of the bullpen. Right now, the Mets can't afford to do that. Is that something we're talking about differently later in the season? Maybe, especially if he struggles. And right now, he's not struggling. Like, five innings, one run is an acceptable performance. Does it put strain on the bullpen? Sure, it does. But what's putting strain on the bullpen is not five innings, one run. It's three innings. It's 2 2/3 innings. Like, that's what really puts the strain on one's bullpen. Five innings doesn't help because you're still looking for four innings out of your pen. But having it happen every single start, that's what makes it tough. Like, if you can mix in a Sean Manaea going six or seven or a David Peterson going six or seven, then a five-inning performance by Clay Holmes is not the end of the world. But it was a very shaky, command wasn't great, but he made the pitch when he needed to kind of outing. And that's really what that game turned into. But it was important to win. It was important to get off the snide. And Jeff McNeil's defensive play should not be forgotten. It was an incredibly important defensive play that helped take game three in the right direction and not the wrong direction. The negative from game three, and it turned out not to kill him because Edwin Diaz did pitch in a non-save situation the following day, was the fact that Jonathan Pitaro, in his major league debut, coming into a game in which he has, you know, a 7-1 lead, can't get the third out, and Mendy has to go to Edwin Diaz with two outs in the ninth inning. That's a negative. The good news is it didn't cost them on Thursday, but it should cost them on Friday. Like, I don't think Edwin Diaz is going to be available for the opener of the Pittsburgh series. And I don't blame Mendy for using Diaz with a four-run lead on Thursday because I think Mendy realized, I just got to win this series. Why am I going to screw around? And also, why am I going to go to somebody else who, if he puts a guy or two on base, I'm going to go to Edwin Diaz anyway? So instead of playing that game, let me just go to Edwin Diaz. Let me just go to him and not mess around. And the other reason why I defend this, because I can see some people questioning going to a closer with a four-run lead. I disagree. I've learned that you should go to your closer with a four-run lead. Who cares what the stats tell you? And here's why. You have a three-batter minimum. Okay? You go to some average to crappy reliever thinking, I'm going to steal not having to use my best reliever. In the worst-case scenario, they put three guys on base. Now you're bringing in your closer with the tying run at the plate. It's basically like bringing him in a one-run game. It's kind of the same thing. And also, that crappy reliever puts a guy on base. What are you doing? You're warming up your closer. So if you're already warming him up, why not just go to him? Why not just bring him in and say, screw it. Let's get the save. Let's, or not the save. Just win the game. So I have learned, especially with the three-batter minimum, to just, why screw around? Let me go to my stopper. Come on in. Get the three outs. Let's go home.
There's one other strategy you could try, which I don't think anybody's done it yet. But if the first batter goes wrong with this, you know, whoever you bring in before your closer, just have him fall to the floor and pull him there. Like, oh, fake injury, pull him out, and then bring in Edwin Diaz. That's got to be a new strategy that you implement. I mean, listen, they do it in the NBA all the time. They do this in football time. Lay down, we'll sub you out. I know that's not great, but that's something that they have to start thinking outside the box to get that three-batter minimum out of the way.
A lot of outside-the-box thinking over the last few days. I've heard a lot of crazy thoughts over the last few days.
Did you hear this one? Did you hear this one that Brandon Nimmo should bat ninth?
Yeah, you were first on that one.
Okay.
Manglehorn, or Mark in Phoenix, as he's called, says, Evan, are you wearing pants? Dude, you're shifting around while talking about Griffin Canning. Let's hope it's not as bad as it looked. And it seems like you're not wearing pants. You should wear pants. Even if it's 11:30 p.m. or whatever back east, you're on YouTube. Put on pants. All right. I am not wearing pants. Now, the good news is, I'm wearing bicycle shorts. Let me stand up. There you go. See, can you see this if you're watching on YouTube? Bicycle shorts. What the hell's wrong with that? It's not like I'm naked. It's not like I'm sitting here, you know, commando. So lay off, man. It's late at night. I took my jeans off. I'm feeling good. Jay Katz writes, Evan and Pete, love the show. Listen to just about every Rico. Can't get enough. I want to propose the idea that Austin Warren should win the Rico I'm the Man Now Star of the Series. With how deflated the dugout looked after Canning went down, I'm sure most Met fans, myself included, saw the Mets meekly losing this game without putting up much of a fight. But then came Austin Warren. I felt he really set the tone by going out and throwing 2 1/3 scoreless innings to keep the Mets afloat while the offense chipped away at Grant Holmes. If he falters, who knows how the rest of the night would have played out, and there's a good chance the bullpen doesn't hold up. Great win overall, huge series split. Now it's time to take care of business in Pittsburgh, LFGM. I definitely think that he is a surprising I'm the Man Now candidate who deserves recognition. Eli writes the same thing. There are a few nominees for the nod, but it should be without a doubt Austin Warren, resetting the tone after the shocking injury to Griffin Canning. I think he's definitely a candidate. And what's unfortunate for Austin Warren is he could potentially win this award, and then his reward is being DFA'd. So let's get to the award, and then we'll look ahead at how to replace Canning, the Pittsburgh series, all that kind of stuff. I think there are really three candidates for this award, in my humble opinion. I think candidate number one is Austin Warren. I think that is certainly compelling to bring his name up. Obviously, I mean, I don't need to re-explain what he just did. He came into a pretty awful situation when Griffin Canning went down, comes right in, gets Acuna in a big spot, runner on second, two outs. Good one hit. He gives up the lead. And yes, the complexion of the game is different, and then goes out and gets six more outs. I think the other candidate, even though his offensive numbers are, they don't jump out at you, is Jeff McNeil. I think Jeff McNeil is a great candidate because of A, the defensive play. That was a very, very important defensive play, like we talked about. He had that double in the ninth inning of the Fugazi rally, but it was a great at-bat. And look, they got Lindor to the plate as the tying run. It ain't Jeff McNeil's fault that Lindor rolled one over and grounded out to second base. So I thought that at bat was another underrated moment. He gets two hits in game three, including a double in the middle of the big five-run inning. And then in the finale of this series, he drives in two runs to break the game open. 2-0 game becomes 4-0 when he comes up with second and third, two outs. So, and the defensive play. I mean, the defensive play is really the highlight. The catch he made against Marcell Ozuna in game three. So I think Jeff McNeil is absolutely another candidate. And then the third one, and I think he's the favorite. This is the guy I kind of went into this podcast thinking is the winner, is Juan Soto. Soto doesn't do anything amazing in game four. He does have a two-out single in the seventh inning, and that kind of pre-led to the Jeff McNeil thing. Alonso doubles, McNeil drives him in, but he hits the two home runs in game three, including a first-pitch home run right after the Braves had tied the game at one. Hits the other home run late, for good measure. A record that seemed to mean a lot to him. Youngest man with multi-home run games. And then even when you go back to the opener of this series, even though he struck out in a big spot, he does hit the two-run home run that got him back in the game. So I think it's Soto. I think it's McNeil. I think it's Austin Warren. Hoff, of those three, or if there's anybody else that maybe I'm excluding from this, who do you lean towards to the Rico, I'm the Man Now star of the series?
The only other person I would throw in there, because you called it, we talked about the BS, you know, Mauricio double, scored a run late or whatever it was, but yet he did have an impact in game three.
Yeah.
He got another hit today. So, I mean, listen, he could be up there as an honorable mention, but just as a mention, I'm not giving it to him. It's Juan Soto 100%. I know the other McNeil, I think, is closer to it than Warren. I appreciate what Warren did. I mean, maybe we should just give it to him because he'll never see another inning this year. But it's Juan Soto, because game three of this series, it made you realize how amazing it's going to be with this man. He set a tone. It wasn't his Met moment, but it's so far has been the biggest moment for Mets fans that Juan Soto is really here and really a Met.
I agree with you. I think it is Juan Soto. I think when you look at this entire series, a long series, a four-game series, even in the first game, the game they lost, their only semblance of offense was him hitting the two-run home run. And it sucked that he also had another opportunity to be the hero, to really put the Mets on his back, and he struck out. And it happens. I mean, he is not perfect. Nobody is perfect. But I think when you look at the entirety of this series, I would agree with you. But talking it over makes me realize it's a lot closer than I thought. Because I think I went into the Rico thinking, yeah, it's Soto. I mean, what are we talking about? But when you think about McNeil's imprints all over this, I think he makes it close. The thing about Austin Warren is it's one game. Now, it's an important game because how we feel today and how we feel tomorrow changes very much on whether they split this series or they lost 3 out of 4, especially with Philadelphia tripping up. So I don't want to minimize the fourth game of this series. It was a really important game. It's a swing game. It's a game that not only swings your emotions, but swings the where the Mets are in the standings. So I think all three of them are great candidates. But I agree with you. When you look at the totality of this, I give Juan Soto the I'm the Man Now star of the series. And what that means for Juan Soto, as I get my chart out, is he has now won the award in back-to-back series.
Ooh.
Believe it or not, this is now the second person to do that. We have only had back-to-back winners one other time. And that, believe it or not, was Francisco Lindor. Back all the way when they swept the St. Louis Cardinals and they swept the Philadelphia Phillies. Remember when they had that incredible 7-0 run against St. Louis and Philadelphia? Well, Lindor put up great numbers. 7-for-18, 2 home runs. 7-for-12, 2 home runs. So he wrapped up the back-to-back award, and for Juan Soto, he's done it again. So let me write down his name in this 2-2 series tie. Now we got the net negative. I got a lot of options for the net negative. I think I just want to give it to Oscar Brazoban, because when you go back to game two of this series and the Mets literally having a lead and us feeling pretty good about things and, you know, Frankie Montas comes back and looks great. By the way, honorable mention of Montas for Rico, I'm the man now. I mean, the guy threw five scoreless innings, like hell of a job. But Brazoban coming in and walking three guys in a row is really bad. I'm also thinking about Jose Castillo, who came in and gave up a hit, hit a batter, and another hit, and for good measure got DFA'd. So I think Brazoban and Castillo are the two pitching options. The other guy I would mention, and I'd hate to give it to him because he's won it a lot this year, is Francisco Lindor. Lindor has cooled off big time. And I think what we're seeing by the lack of criticism he is facing just everywhere is it goes to show you that Lindor has really earned a lot of trust from Met fans. That his season last year, which was incredibly special, it was an MVP candidate, obviously had epic postseason moments, has really gotten anyone off of criticizing him because he's been a mess. I mean, he had a terrible series, but I don't want to give it to him. I just think it's wrong. I do. First of all, he hit a home run that got robbed. Michael Harris took a home run away from him. So I guess technically he at least would have had that. But I think the bullpen implosion from game two is really what sticks with me from this series more than anything else. So I'm going to give you the choice off. Do we give it to Brazoban or do we give it to Jose Castillo? Because those to me are the two net negative choices based on the implosion from game two of this series.
So I just want to preface this with, I am a huge Brazoban supporter. I've put it, I have facts. You could check me on Twitter. I have a tweet out there that said Brazoban is going to be the best trade at the deadline for next year. I think he's unbelievable. I think he's going to be a star reliever. But that being said, he sucked ass and basically cost us another win, and that can't happen. He got an out. I'm happy, which is more than what Castillo got, but he also gave up three runs. He basically imploded and basically gave the game away. So F him. He gets the net negative.
Yeah, I kind of lean towards that. Jose Castillo is now dead to us because he's gone. Like, we hardly knew ye. By the way, Jose Castillo won a Rico Star of the Series. So he has that on his resume back in the White Sox series that they won. Castillo had a couple of pretty good performances there and actually was not only a serviceable reliever for this team, won a Rico I'm the Man Now Star of the Series. But I agree with you. I think the Brazoban, look, you come into a game and you have a lead and you have a relatively comfortable lead. The one thing you can't do is walk three straight guys. It just can't happen. So I agree with you. Waskar Brazoban, for the first time this year, you are the net negative from this split against Atlanta. Let's get to some more of your emails. We like to interact with you, therico@gmail.com. Dallas writes, I hope one day the Rico will appreciate Jeff McNeil without talking about trading him in the next breath. So accurate, Dallas. So accurate. We need to talk about the fifth spot in the lineup as a black hole. Oh, I'm sorry. We need to not talk about the fifth spot in the lineup as a black hole. McNeil has an 834 OPS, 137 OPS plus. He's out there stealing home runs, playing center field. His versatility is invaluable to the Mets at this point with the injuries and underperformance that have hit this team. Is Cedric Mullins and his minus 3.3 WAR in center field better than McNeil? Hell no. I think that Jeff McNeil right now, I don't trust him. Like, I think two things can be true, Dallas. I just put him over big time. I thought that catch was one of the most important defensive plays the Mets have made this season, and I think his imprints were all over this series. Jeff McNeil's playing well. There's no denying that. He is, and his spot in the lineup, which has now basically become fifth, protecting Pete Alonso, he's been a productive ball player for a while now. And for a while, what, a couple of weeks? But he's been productive. Do I trust him? Not really. I'll admit that. Do I want him to be the everyday center fielder? Not really. But you're right about the versatility. The fact that he can play second base, the fact that he can play center field, the fact that he can play left field really allows the Mets a lot of versatility during a time in which there are a lot of spots that are still up for grabs where you just want to play the hot hand. You know, Ronnie Mauricio, who is really bidding to remain on this roster as Mark Vientos is activated, you know, Ronnie Mauricio, second base, Beatty, third base, Vientos, DH, McNeil in center, maybe their best lineup. And I'm okay with that for now. The key word being for now, because what we have to learn is that we're all with playing the hot hand and riding who's performing, but that won't last always. And we sat here on the Rico not that long ago saying Luis Angel Acuña needed to be the everyday second baseman. We saw what happened. He stopped performing. He didn't play a lot. Nobody complained about him not playing a lot. And now he's in AAA. I think if McNeil in center field is their best offensive option, that's fine. They're just going to need to take him out of games or move someone out of games so they can improve their defense late. Is Cedric Mullins an upgrade? No, I don't think Cedric Mullins is that appealing right now because, like, his defense is okay, but his bat is such a negative that you feel okay with Tyrone Taylor. You feel like, all right, I'll stick with Tyrone Taylor, who's been here, who's a grinder, who's got a good glove, with McNeil basically platooning with him. So I think if you're looking for a center fielder, and I think the Mets are, and I think we will be talking about center fielders, I think you are going to want somebody who's more productive than Cedric Mullins.
All right. So I don't want to be this guy, but I'm going to be this guy. Trade Jeff McNeil. No, I'm joking. But I'm going to tell you something. That grab in center field made me feel a little more confident that you can use him in center field. You can use him at left field the days that you need to spell and give Nimmo a breather on the field and make Nimmo the DH. And that's your rotation of, and you know what? I hate to say this. I do want to call up Luis Angel Acuña. The reason why he stopped performing because he stopped playing. That's why he stopped performing.
You're calling him up to play where though right now?
I mean, second base.
But
he had a spark. He had a spark to him that nobody else had. I'm sorry.
He didn't perform for like a month. I know he didn't play a lot, but when given the opportunities, he didn't perform. Like right now, the Mets have a lot of options. I'll tell you one guy who's also kind of making his bid to continue to play is Brett Beatty. Brett Beatty's performing. All of a sudden, Brett Beatty's gotten hot again. You know, he had the RBI single in game three, had two hits in that game. He had another hit in this game, drew a walk, and he's also continued to play really good defense at third base. The Mets' best lineup slash defensive alignment upon Vientos' return, who I want to see play. Like, I want Mark Vientos out there every day. I want to see if they can get his back going now that he's healthy. It may be Beatty at third base, Mauricio at second, Vientos at DH, and McNeil in center field. But this is going to be a really interesting decision and test for David Stearns. And I say David Stearns because he's making the decision. And that is when Vientos comes back, which is essentially now, who's going down? If they are prioritizing playing every day, the way they did with Acuña, the way they did with Alvarez, then Ronnie Mauricio is going down to the minor leagues despite a good couple of days. But if they're going to go, hey, he's performed, we can find a way to get him at bats, then the guy who should go down is Jared Young. And if we're just making decisions based on the players, the better players, the guys we have more confidence in, then of course Jared Young is going down. But if the decision is based on playing time, that's where things get complicated. I can map out a way, until Winker comes back, because that would complicate things. I can map out a way in which Ronnie Mauricio and Brett Beatty and Mark Vientos are all getting plenty of at-bats. It ain't that complicated. Who loses out? I think Tyrone Taylor probably loses out. But without bashing Tyrone Taylor, because this isn't a bash of him, it's just the reality, he's a fourth outfielder. Like, we've known this for a year and a half. It doesn't mean he stinks. Doesn't mean I want to get rid of him. He's just, that's what he is. And that's okay. It's like Harrison Bader last year when Hoff was, you know, going nuts when the Mets signed him. He's a fourth outfielder. And that's what Tyrone Taylor is. Tommy Rose writes, after all that, we're back in first place. All the sucky play, the huge losing streak, the blown games late, the underbelly of the rotation being shown, the underbelly of the bullpen being shown, the limp offense, the offensive explosion game that was sure to lead to something, the following day that proved that it didn't, Pete's slump, Francisco's slump, Alvarez's demotion, 5-9, struggling to get a freaking hit, After all that, pull your hair out. 10 games against the division Titans. We're back in first place. Baseball is wild. It's all true. This has been an awful stretch, and you described a lot of it, and the Mets are in first place after 82 games. Michael writes, Evan and Pete, does this series, this split against Atlanta, eclipse the split in LA in 2022 as the greatest split in baseball history? I'll hang up and listen. Now, Michael clearly is a longtime Rico listener, because all the way back, I think this was like the very beginning of the Rico Brogna, how many episodes ago this was, back in 2022, the Mets went to LA. Okay, not the series at Citi Field, where Nimmo made the great catch, DeGrom pitched, the Mets won 2 out of 3. Not talking about that. They had a series in LA in which they lost the first 2 games, and then they won the next 2 games, including the Sunday afternoon game being like a crazy, exciting, hold-on-for-life victory. And yes, I was declaring it the greatest split in the history of the Mets. And I asked people, I defy you. Find me a split better than that. This is not the greatest split in Met history. I know it feels great because they got these last 2 games, but there's still that we split against the Braves. You know, we're at home. The Braves are under 500. Like, there's still that disappointment that they even lost the first 2 games. So, no, I don't think it's the greatest split in Mets history. I think that series in LA still holds the crown as the greatest split. I think this is a sense of relief more than anything. I mean, you start the season 0-5 against an Atlanta Brave team that, you know, against everybody else, isn't that good? Now, they face some tough pitchers. We can't ignore that in the 5 games that the Mets lost to Atlanta, they faced Spencer Schwellenbach twice, who they can't hit, Spencer Strider twice, and Chris Sale prior to his injury. That is not exactly easy. Now they face Grant Holmes and Didier Fuentes. Now, it's a little bit easier. But no, it's a relief that they won these last 2 games, especially with the help they got from the Astros to get back to first place. But the greatest split ever is still that series in LA. Jose writes, Evan and Hoff, with Cannon going down, it's time for the Mets to use an opener going forward. I nominate Jose Buteau. And we could call up one of the pitching prospects to be the bulk guy. Plus, with Buteau, we can slowly extend him to 3, 4, even 5 innings over time. I understand that the Mets don't see Buteau that way, but they're running out of effective starters, and it's easy to trade for relief help than a starter. I do agree, and I think the reason why it's easier to trade for relief help than a starter is that you don't have to trade for an elite reliever. You can basically take, like the Mets did, lottery tickets out on relievers, and they're very, very up and down. Let's examine this rotation issue that they now face, because the Griffin Canning thing is obviously bad. We have to assume he doesn't exist anymore because he's not going to pitch again. They will have David Peterson start the opener in Pittsburgh. They will have Paul Blackburn pitch Saturday afternoon in Pittsburgh, and they will have Frankie Montas make his second start also in Pittsburgh. So this weekend, not affected. Then they have an off day. The beautiful part about the way they allotted this rotation is that Clay Holmes would start Tuesday against Milwaukee with an extra day of rest. If the Mets are comfortable pitching everyone else on regular rest, they can go Peterson for Game 2 against Milwaukee, Blackburn for Game 3 against Milwaukee, Frankie Montas to open up the Subway Series, and then the first time they would need to add somebody, whether it's Jose's idea of an opener or calling up a kid from the minor leagues or whomever, would potentially be Saturday against the Yankees. Now, they could do it earlier. I mean, they don't have to wait to Saturday. They're going to have to add someone to replace Griffin Canning. If they somehow believed Sean Manaea could be ready for the weekend against the Yankees, then it would pay to continue to push this off. That's not going to happen. Like, the odds are Manaea, if he is able to get to a rehab game, it's probably early next week, and then I think they probably have him in Baltimore against the Orioles more so than the Yankee series. But I guess it's possible if they feel comfortable enough getting Manaea to pitch, you know, even just doing the math, it's not going to work. Like, he can't pitch Monday. I don't think there's any minor league games on Monday. So he gets into a rehab game on Tuesday. If you want to bring him on regular rest, that's Sunday. You're going to need someone by Saturday. Now, if you don't want that against the Yankees for whatever reason, some people think the Subway Series is some kind of big deal. It's not. It's a big deal when you're there. It's a big deal talking trash to your friends. At the end of the day, you don't have to manipulate your rotation for the Subway Series. What's the point? But if Mendy wants to do that, then you can insert a young starter in the Milwaukee Series and push everybody back a day. Now, what starter are the options? Jose says, let's use an opener. Of course, I guess you can. We've seen the Mets do it before. You could start Waskar Brazoban. He suggested Jose Buteau and go to Brandon Waddell or go to Justin Hagenman. Or you could go back to Blake Tidwell. Blake Tidwell was actually relatively impressive in his start last Friday against Philadelphia. Brandon Sproat has not pitched well. I don't think he's an option. I don't think Jonah Tong is an option. Nolan McLean, I wish is an option. And I think if they're going to go to McLean, it would probably be in the Milwaukee Series more so than telling him to make his major league debut against the Yankees. Though the Mets have a great history of having young players make their major league debut against the Yankees, as we recall with Jacob DeGrom. But right now, the Mets don't have to replace Canning until as late as a week from Saturday because of the off days. And that's what's also going to help them, because after they play the Yankees, they have another off day. Then they play a 6-game road trip, 3-3, Baltimore, Kansas City, and that's it. And that's the All-Star break. And then you get to recalibrate and kind of hopefully get healthy, because they need to get healthy. I mean, this rotation is just, it's taking a beating. Now, Pete Hoffman was saying to me, they got to go at a starter right now. I've laid out the situation that they're in where they don't need a starter until the end of the Yankee series. And then maybe they would need someone in the Baltimore, Kansas City series. But if Manaea is back, then they don't to replace Griffin Canning. And then you have the All-Star break. So knowing that, knowing you may need one start from someone outside of this group until Manaea comes back, and then it's the All-Star break, do you still feel an urgency to add a starting pitcher?
I do, because this bullpen is still very taxed. That's a God's honest truth. You know, even though you just said Edwin Diaz, you know, may not pitch Friday. Why? Because he pitched back-to-back days. Even though on Wednesday he pitched 4 pitches. Let's be serious. He should be able to go Friday. But regardless, I don't trust that this bullpen is going to be fresh enough. You need to be able to. I know the All-Star break is around the corner, but these games matter. And you can't go into a game anymore and say, let's cross our fingers that our pitcher can give us 3 solid innings. Our starting pitcher can give us 3 to 4 solid innings. It's not good enough anymore.
But what starting pitcher are you getting on the trade market in late June, early July that's going to give you the innings you just described?
I mean, you got to make offers that are over the top. I mean, dude, if you blow away a team right now, the Marlins are out of it. If Sandy Alcantara, I don't know, I've heard he's not on the trade market, but if you blow him away and say, listen, let's get this done now, here's a load of players, I'm fine with it.
I don't think this is the time to do that. I think that the problem we run into is that there are a lot of teams that are just not going to start trading guys off. You know, even the teams that are out of it, that are clearly out of it, like Miami and Washington and Pittsburgh and Colorado and the White Sox, they're not selling guys off yet. Like, they're going to wait. They're going to wait till mid-July and late July. And then the real interesting thing is when teams that are talented say, all right, we're out. You know what? We're not really in this race. And so we're talking about teams like Arizona and Cincinnati, like Cleveland, teams that have talent. So right now, the only guys you're adding are guys that are DFA'd. You're adding the bodies that are being released by one team and being picked up by another team. So the Mets have to survive this stretch. And I think they're equipped to do it because of the off days I described. And I'm not telling you that Paul Blackburn is like amazing. Ideally, Paul Blackburn leaves the rotation. You know, ideally, he goes and becomes a long man, even though he wasn't exactly good at that either.
Ideally, Paul Blackburn gets DFA'd.
Yeah, well, eventually. Unfortunately, right now they need him. You know, and when Senga and Manaea are healthy, and I say when, let's hope that they are, they'll be in a more position of strength. But right now, I think it's just about surviving. And then at the trade deadline, which to me is like mid-July, like July 15th, probably the All-Star break. We're sitting there at the All-Star break. We'll have a little bit better of an idea on what teams are out of it and what players are going to be available. And obviously what the Mets should go after. Is it going to be a starter? Is it bullpen help? Is it a center fielder? I know we're anxious for it, but we're still not there yet. We're just not there yet.
And I totally get that. And I understand that maybe I'm getting a little antsy, but it's not even like, hey, I don't think this starting pitching is going to, you know, be able to shut down offenses. No, I bet they're still going to pitch to, like, you know, a little bit above the 3 ERA for the next
No, it's going 2 weeks. Deep into games. I agree with you.
Yeah, that's all it is because that's the other part of it. That's how you win games is with the bullpen. And if the bullpen's overused, then let me ask you a question. And I know that there's no stoppage of let's opt guys out, let's call this guy up, let's DFA this guy. There's endless moves that they can make, but my God, is that really the future of how they're going to last the rest of the season?
It's not the future, it's surviving this period of time. I mean, they're going through a period of time in which they have not gotten length out of their starters. In this case with Griffin Canning, it was because he got hurt. Like, yeah, it looked like he was destined for at least 5 innings. You know, we'll see. Maybe it would have ended earlier, but some of it is circumstance. Even David Peterson. Like, David Peterson's usually an innings eater, but last Sunday against the Phillies, he gets knocked out after 4 innings. So they're just going through a stretch right now in which they're not getting innings to an extreme level. Like, they don't get a lot of innings from their starters in general, even with that great team ERA, but this has been extreme. So, yeah, they're forced on a daily basis to make all these roster moves just because of the circumstances they're in right now. There's just not any big move to be made right now. The only moves you're going to make is you're going to pick someone up off waivers. That's it. You're going to add yourself a fresh arm. But that's not the long-term answer. We're going to know. Now, sometimes you just know, and we're not there yet to know what the Mets have to add at the trade deadline. And I think what's going to help determine that is Sean Manaea. This Sean Manaea thing is really important. The loose bodies thing is scary. I saw him throwing today when I was at Citi Field on Thursday. Hopefully this means he's going to make a rehab start. And if all of that can go well, that's a huge help. If it doesn't, if we get a Sean Manaea setback, well, then we have to brace for the fact that no one's walking through that door because Senga is not days away. Senga's not weeks away. Senga's probably over a month away. That's a long damn time. That's after the trade deadline. Honestly, I'd be surprised if Senga's making a start before the trade deadline. So I think the Manaea news, whatever it turns out to be, is going to be really, really important. And if we get good news, we should celebrate. And you know, you could celebrate your highlights with Mio Sparkling Sake, a true crowd pleaser, light, bubbly, and easy to enjoy, whether you're at Citi Field or your favorite spot. Ask for Mio Sparkling Sake by name. A new tradition served chilled, imported from Japan, the official sake of Rico Bronya. Enjoy responsibly. I did get mocked for it, but that bucket hat giveaway was tremendous. Love the bucket hat, the reversible bucket hat. And it actually led to the Mets selling out Thursday night's game. They've had big crowds basically every day. Got to make Steve Cohen happy, but a sellout on a Thursday night against the Atlanta Braves. What's next? Here's what's next. They got to beat the Pirates. The Pirates are a lousy team. They're not facing Paul Skeens. There is no excuse. Get 3, make us all happy. Maybe the Phillies get tripped up when they take on the Atlanta Braves, and all of a sudden being back in first place can turn into a first place lead. And then a much needed off day before they play Milwaukee and the Yankees for the final homestand ahead of the All-Star break. But Met fans, feel good. Despite the recent stretch, despite the injuries, despite what happened to Canning, despite the offense, you know, making you want to pull your hair out at times, the New York Mets are a first-place team. And that's good news. So thank you very much for listening and downloading episode 505 of the Rico Bronya. Make sure you subscribe to the Rico Bronya. We always have Ricos after every single series. Give you your series recap. the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series in the net negative. But as you may have noticed this week with this series against Atlanta, episodes 503 and 504, we also like to mix in some instant reactions, including drive home Ricos. So subscribe so you never miss an edition. Thank you very much for listening to Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.